All right. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases for oral argument this morning. One has been postponed due to illness, so we'll go straight to our first and only case on the morning docket for oral argument, which is Rodriguez versus State 2-15-245-CR for May 24th, 2016. And to my right is Justice Leanne Dofino. To my left is Justice Ann Gardner, and I'm Chief Justice Terry Livingston. And I understand you all have checked in with your times, and so I guess you're ready to proceed. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Okay. First, we'll have, is it Mr. Rasmussen?
Actually, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, Rhett. Bose, okay. Can you spell your first name?
Yes, Your Honor. It's David, D-A-V-I-D, Bost, B as in boy, O-S-T as in Thomas.
Okay. And you're taking your full 15 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then Jennifer Ponder, correct, for the state?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And your full 15 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. All right, Mr. Bost, then, if you are ready to proceed, we will begin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. At its heart, this case is about the simple phrase, failed to notify law enforcement about a change of address within 7 days. It's a simple phrase. An appellate contends that it can only mean one thing, the common and ordinary meaning that every one of us thinks when we hear that phrase, that a person moved and then failed to tell law enforcement. The problem is, the law enforcement in the state's amended indictment is the Wichita Falls law enforcement, which would be a crime, but not under the facts presented at trial. At trial, the court corrected the state's error in the indictment and charged the jury as the record indicates. This case is extremely similar to the case in Thomas, as cited in appellant's brief. The legal rule, although a bit of a Russian nesting doll, starts the same as the Thomas case with a sufficiency challenge. As the court knows, in a sufficiency challenge, the standard is whether, after viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. However, the rule requires that mandates a hypothetically correct jury charge, which, as the court knows, requires, under the hypothetically correct jury charge, the jury charge accurately sets out the law, is authorized by the indictment, does not unnecessarily increase the state's burden or restrict the state's theories of liability, and adequately describes the particular offense for which the defendant was tried. Appellant takes issue with the problem in the hypothetically correct jury charge is element 2 and 4, which is authorized by the indictment and adequately describes the particular offense for which the defendant was tried. Authorized by the indictment, according to Curry and Thomas, is the rule for authorized by the indictment is that the statutory elements of the offense are the statutory elements of the offense and those modified by the indictment. But the state may not rely on other statutory manner and means that it did not plead in the charging instrument. And that's basically the crux of this case, is that appellant contends that the state relied, or the charge relied on an indictment did not include the manner and means alleged in the indictment. So sufficiency of the evidence is actually measured by specific elements that the state alleged in the indictment. Material, as Cotta and Thomas state.
Okay, let me ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
In order to commit this offense, do you have to fail to tell them in advance and fail to tell them after you get there? Or can you violate the statute by violating part of the statute? Or have you committed some kind of lesser included that I don't think I know about? Or if you take out half of the elements of the offense, have you committed the offense a different way, not committed the offense, or committed half an offense or a different offense? What have you committed?
Well, Your Honor, the appellant contends, I believe the case law supports, that there are two statutorily separate ways to violate this section of code. One of the statutory manner and means in violating this section of code.
Tell me what you think.
What I think is that the if a defendant moves to a place is required to register and then does not notify the new locate law enforcement of their change of address within 7 days, that would be one way to violate the statute. The other way would be if they anticipated a move date at their previous residence and didn't notify that previous residence's law enforcement within 7 days before the anticipated move. So those would be two separate statutory manner and means.
If they didn't do either one, could they be indicted for two felony offenses? One, failure to report that they anticipated moving to the new address, and then after they get there, failing to report their new address to the new authorities, the authorities in the new location. Or are they? They're separate offenses.
Your Honor, I believe as the statute is written, I believe they would be separate offenses and might be in different jurisdictions depending on where the move occurred to and from. And the issue we have here, or the appellant's issue, is that the state indicted as our brief lays out, the state indicted a post-move failure to notify the Wichita Falls Police Department. But an indictment under these facts could have been a valid indictment, well, under the charge, could have been a pre-move failure to notify the Wichita Falls Police Department, or in a different jurisdiction in Hardeman County, could have been a post-move failure to notify Vernon Police Department, Chief of Police, or local law enforcement authority as designated by the statute.
So when they took out Vernon, what was the result in the indictment?
So the result in the indictment is an indictment that alleges that he failed to notify the Wichita Falls Police Department after he moved, which is not what the state presented at trial. Well, which is not a crime under these facts.
How so?
What words are you relying on to say it was after the move that he failed to report?
I'm relying on the common and ordinary meaning of failed to notify law enforcement about a change of address within 7 days.
You're getting that directly from the amended indictment?
The state's amended indictment.
Okay, and the amendment came during trial or right before trial in March? Or is that the date that he... No, because it's got the March 10th date of 2014 earlier on in the indictment.
I believe the amendment came at the beginning of trial.
Okay.
I think, I believe shortly before the jury was sworn, but I could be incorrect about that.
Yeah, because it's got initials of probably Judge Brotherton and a date of March in 2015.
So you're saying within 7 days could be seven before or seven after?
Well, the appellant's contention is that the plain and ordinary meaning of a combination of the words about a change of address within 7 days without any prepositions or modifying language identifies a change of address and then within 7 days after that change.
After or before?
Your Honor, it's the...
He could have notified him before and still have complied with the statute or not. If they had proved that 2 days before he moved, he had notified them that he was moving, wouldn't that be within 7 days? Wouldn't that be a failure to prove he did not notify him within 7 days?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's...
I understand it's not your facts, but if we read it the way you want us to, then within 7 days can be 7 days before or 7 days after. It's not limited. It's not restricted. Is that right?
The error is the local agency.
I understand. But within 7 days, you said a plain reading of within 7 days.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the statute does say, with respect to reporting to Wichita Falls or Wichita, doesn't say he has to report within 7 days. I think I see your argument. What it says is no later than 7 days before.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anticipated move. No later than 7 days before, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's not the same as within 7 days.
Yes, Your Honor. Correct. Yes.
That's an excellent restatement.
Right.
Okay.
So under the Thomas Law and associated law as cited in the appellant's brief, the harm in this case must be egregious for the court to reverse the trial court. And in this case, appellant believes, based on the case law, that this harm was egregious, extremely similar to Thomas, it's the reverse facts of Thomas, essentially. Thomas alleged the indictment alleged a pre-move failure of notice, and the charge alleged a post-move failure of notice. So, except flipping those on its head, in Thomas, Texarkana ruled that this harm was egregious because there was a fatal variance between the indictment and charge that affected the heart and soul of the jury charge. And that denied, in that case, Mr. Thomas, in this case, Mr. Rodriguez, the valuable right to have the jury decide his guilt on a proper basis authorized. And in this case, there was a conviction that was not alleged in the indictment, and that's a violation of his basic right to for the jury to decide his guilt on the proper basis authorized.
But he didn't report to either the Wichita or the Vernon Authority his existing place of residence or, according to the state, the one he moved to. So how is he harmed?
He's harmed because he was denied the right to be indicted under for the jury to decide his guilt on a proper basis, under the rules which require that the jury charge be authorized by the indictment. In this case, the jury charge wasn't authorized by the indictment, and that denies him a valuable right. Basically, he was indicted for a crime under the amended indictment. He was indicted for a crime that he did not, that wasn't a crime under these circumstances. He was indicted for a crime that he wasn't charged with. He was charged with a different crime than he was indicted for. As our brief states, appellant requests that this court reverse the trial court and based on the Thomas case as well as other cited authorities, and requests that and believes that that's in the best interest of justice and a good order under case law.
I'm sorry?
And a valid and supported order under the Thomas case and associated cases.
All right, Mr. Bose, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we'll proceed with Ms. Ponder, please.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. Wichita County and the State respectfully request that you affirm the judgment of the 30th District Court. The evidence was sufficient to convict the appellant because there was no variance between the hypothetically correct jury charge authorized by the limited indictment and the actual jury charge. Further, Thomas v. State is distinct because its indictment was narrow, specifying only one manner and means, whereas in this case, our indictment was very broad. Even if there was a variance, that variance is non-statutory and immaterial. The appellant received sufficient notice, and he's not at risk for double jeopardy. The trial court did not err in its charge, therefore, appellant suffered no harm. Briefly, Your Honors, I would like to address a couple of points from appellant's argument. I believe that appellant was unclear about what happened with the indictment. There was the original indictment, and after the state's voir dire, before the defendant's or the appellant's voir dire began, the state moved to abandon the language Andrew Vernon. And at that time, there was no objection from appellant, and then the court abandoned that and struck out the words Andrew Vernon. So it was not a correction of an error, it was an abandonment by the state of a manner and means. Appellant was convicted of failure of a sex offender to notify law enforcement of a move. The language of the original indictment reads, appellant, while being a person required to register with local law enforcement authority, to wit, Wichita and or Vernon, intentionally or knowingly failed to notify law enforcement about a change of address within 7 days.
So let me ask this then. Under the indictment as originally indicted, is it state's position then that the state could have proved up either or both claims, failure to notify before and after, or were they limited to just one offense?
Your Honor, under the original indictment, the state could have proven either manner or means, could have proved that either a failure to notify Wichita or a failure to notify Vernon. The state's not required to narrow its pleading like a DWI when proving a .08 versus a loss of faculties. And by alleging Wichita and or Vernon, there's not a specific manner and means being alleged in the original indictment. And therefore, both manner and means were available to the state at that time. However, by abandoning the language and or Vernon, factually and the only thing that the state could proceed on, given this information, was a failure to notify Wichita. As the appellant acknowledged in his brief, the Wichita Falls Police Department is the primary registration authority, and Vernon would be the local law enforcement agency that would need to be referred to after a move. Thomas is distinct because the language of the indictment and that specified a failure to notify before an anticipated move, but what was proven at trial and what the jury charge read was failure to notify after. Even assuming that there was a variance, that variance is immaterial. It was a non-statutory variance. The difference between the language of within versus not later than is non-statutory. However, it's the context that's important. In 62.055A, it is not later than the seventh day before or not later than the seventh day after. However, as seen in the indictment in this particular case, it is about the case within 7 days. So the context for that includes both the before and after up until Andrew Vernon was abandoned. Within, also, let's say that within means within, inside of the 7 days, or even after the 7 days after the move. So if the move date was the 8th, that means that statutorily, appellant was required to notify by the 1st. However, if, let's say, within means all the way out to the 15th, if the state alleged he didn't notify by the 15th, in this particular case, the state is still proving the evidence because he never notified Wichita. He never notified them at any point in time, not on the 1st and not on the 15th. And that was his defense at trial. He didn't testify, but that was his girlfriend's testimony, and also that was his defense in his brief, was that the defendant denied he ever moved or intended to move. So he never registered or notified of any move at any point. This is much like if you were to try to pay your rent. If your rent's due on the 1st and you still haven't paid it by the 15th, you never paid your rent on the 1st. The greater necessarily includes the lesser. The alleged non-statutory variance is immaterial because it didn't violate appellant's substantial rights. The state was not required to allege a specific manner and means so long as the appellant was on notice.
Notice of what?
Notice of the offense, of what he was being charged with.
If you don't have to allege manner and means, but he does have to be on notice of what acts of his he committed that violated the statute, how do you put him on notice of his unlawful acts if you don't have to tell him a manner and means?
In this particular case, Your Honor, there were only two manner and means available. The original indictment allowed for both, and by not being required to limit it, both were available. In addition, there were 53914 disclosures that provided all of the police reports, etc., by the state to the appellant, starting about 8 months prior to trial beginning. So he was very aware of everything that the state could have produced at trial. In addition,
he could have also said, you violated the law. And then let him look at your file to see everything that you thought he did wrong. How would that put him on notice of what he's being tried for?
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, he was given notice of the specific offense, being a violation of 62.055, failure to notify, when he had a duty to notify because he was required to register. So in addition to providing those 3914 disclosures, 2 weeks prior to the trial, the prosecutor informed the appellant's counsel of his intent to abandon the language and or Vernon. He stated this on the record when he abandoned it, and the appellant's counsel did not object to this characterization. Furthermore, if the appellant was confused about what he was going to trial about, he could have filed a motion to quash. Up until the day before trial, if there's any question, if there's any ambiguity about what they were proceeding on, the appellant should have filed a motion to quash, but he did not. Further, there was no objection at the time of the abandonment. Appellant had no objection at the charging conference, and it was the judge who initiated any discussion about Thomas and then denied any similarity between the two, saying that they found that he found that Thomas was dissimilar. The limited indictment did not impair appellant's ability to prepare his defense or his actual defense. His trial strategy was that he never moved, and he did nothing to defend against a failure to notify Vernon. Appellant is not at risk for being tried for this offense again. Earlier, I believe Bill asked whether a failure to notify before and a failure to notify after were two separate offenses. The answer is no. It is the failure to notify is determined by it's determined by the unit of move. So any free time there's a change of address is what the gravamen is, as opposed to the unit of prosecution is per change of address, not the means in which the person was required to report. And that's in Young versus State, as discussed in the state's brief. So because he cannot be tried for this offense again, he is not at risk for double jeopardy. There was no error in the jury charge, therefore there was no harm. Your Honors, in conclusion, I request that you affirm the decision of the 30th District Court. and uphold the appellant's conviction. The evidence was sufficient to convict appellant because there was no variance between the hypothetically correct jury charge authorized by the limited indictment and the actual jury charge. Even if there was a variance, it was a non-statutory variance in which appellant received plenty of notice. Both all the state, the court, and the appellant were all aware of what they were proceeding to trial about, and appellant is not at risk for double jeopardy. Finally, there was no variance.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, if you are indicting him under this statute, you can convict him of failure to give notice before he moves, failure to give notice after he moves, or both failure to give notice before and after. If you give notice before, but you don't give notice after, have you committed an offense?
Yes, Your Honor. You could commit an offense by failing to notify before, failing to notify after, or failing to notify before or after.
But you only have to prove half of that in order to get a conviction, but you can't prosecute for both of them. Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, I'm saying that the unit of prosecution is per move. So it's an alternative manner and means. Again, this was in Young versus State, in which...
Alternative or a joint manner and means?
There are alternative manner and means, Your Honor.
So if he violates one, he's guilty as though he had violated both. But if he complies with one, he's still guilty.
Correct. If he's violated either of those manner and means.
What's the purpose of the statute? What's the legislative intent?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the legislative intent, but I'm more than happy to file a supplemental brief if you would like for me to.
To know where sex offenders are?
Yes, it's for the, so that the local, I would presume, and Your Honor, I have not done the research, but it's to know so that the local authorities know that somebody is moving into or away from their jurisdiction.
When you give notice, you have to give notice where you're going, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So he moved from Wichita Falls to Vernon?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the Wichita, if you'd given notice in Wichita Falls, the Wichita Falls folks would know that he's going to Vernon?
If he had given notice, yes, Your Honor.
And what about imputed knowledge? If one branch of law enforcement knows something, that knowledge is imputed to the other branch, isn't it?
Your Honor, I understand what you're saying. However, because the statute is set out in the way it is, where the legislature clearly articulated that he has a duty to notify the primary registration authority and the secondary one, the local law enforcement authority to which he is moving, that regardless of whether there is an imputed knowledge or not, he still had a duty to notify both of them.
So form triumphs over substance. If the purpose of the statute is to know where sex offenders are, and that's accomplished because it wasn't done in the right form or on the right form, you've violated the statute?
Your Honors, I believe that we have to, the legislature intends for every portion of its statutes to be honored. If a word or a phrase is included, it means that it's in there for a reason.
Well, y'all took out Vernon.
Yes, Your Honor, that was an abandonment. Legislative history and legislative, what the legislature does, I believe in the laws of statutory construction, and again, Your Honor, I have not researched this particular issue regarding this particular statute, but the legislature intends for all everything included in the statute to be applied and to be used, which is very different from an indictment in which the state can abandon an alternative manner and means, and that's actually from Eastet versus State, even though it was overruled by Golahan, that portion is still there. Abandoning an alternative manner and means does not deprive a defendant of notice or ability to prepare his defense.
I had a question. You said he was notified 2 weeks before trial of something. What was it? I didn't quite catch that.
Sorry if I was unclear.
It wasn't you. I don't think it was me.
The prosecutor notified appellant's counsel 2 weeks before the trial that he intended to abandon the language and or Vernon, and then he followed through and did abandon that language.
Okay.
And this is on the record.
That's in the record, I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am. Would you like a record cite?
Oh, if you have it handy.
Yes, ma'am. It's volume 3, page 75.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Ponder. Mr. Bose, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, appellant would respectfully present to the court that under this statute, as written now, a post-move failure to notify the Wichita Falls law enforcement is not a crime under the facts as presented by the state. The state is now trying to introduce ambiguity in the indictment where one did not previously exist.
Well, tell us why it's not.
Because the statute lays out two separate manner and means, mm-hmm. One of which,
it's before and it's after.
Correct. And the requirements of notifying the law enforcement are different. It's the first one requires a notification of, the first one being the pre-move notice, requires a notification of the law enforcement where the person resides before the move. The second manner and means requires the second statutory manner and means requires a person to notify new law enforcement within 7 days after the move, as in the new home. So the state is now trying to introduce ambiguity where it did not previously, I'm sorry.
Okay, so he didn't give notice, right? They proved he didn't give notice?
Your Honor, Mr. Rodriguez presented at trial that he didn't move, but there was the statement of facts lays out what proof was presented at trial.
I'm just trying to figure what you're arguing here.
What I'm arguing is that he was deprived of an important right that caused egregious harm to have a jury decide his guilt on the proper basis under an authorized jury charge.
Which would have been?
In this case, an authorized jury charge would have followed the indictment, which would have been that he failed to notify Wichita Falls. That wouldn't be authorized either, because that wouldn't be an accurate statement of the law as applied to these facts. Excuse me. The jury charge should have laid out the statute as written and asked, and should have said a post-move failure to notify the new residence law enforcement. Under these facts, because the state abandoned the Vernon language, which incidentally is in a different county than Wichita, the state didn't indict that. So there wouldn't have been there's an egregious error and the material fatal variance between the indictment and the charge. That's the appellant's contention. Under the plain and ordinary meaning of the indictment, It's alleges a post-move failure, which again, to notify the Wichita Falls law enforcement, which again wouldn't have been a crime under these circumstances. It was a narrow indictment, not a broad indictment. The trial court, however, attempted to fix the error in the indictment and did not mimic the state's erroneous indictment. As to objection and motions to quash, the reason that we're under the egregious harm standard, which Thomas applies, is because there was not an objection. There was a motion for mistrial and a motion for a new trial. The motion for a new trial was filed before, and the motion for mistrial was made verbally at a hearing regarding this issue, which was post-verdict but pre-punishment phase. As Almanza lays out, the appellant respectfully requests the court to see where common sense coincides with the fair administration of justice and to reverse the verdict in this case, as the Thomas Court did in Texarkana in 2014. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bost. Ms. Ponder, we appreciate all of your arguments today as well as all of your briefing, and we appreciate you being here in Fort Worth as well. Your case is now submitted, and that being our only case on the morning docket, we will adjourn.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
Thank you.